Welcome to the Role Models Podcast. My name is David. This is a special episode for me. It is special because it's episode number 20. So it's a perfect moment to pause and to celebrate and to thank you all for joining me on this journey of creating this podcast and most importantly, for listening to it. I personally learned a lot from my role models who every week are a really great source of inspiration. And I know from the emails, tweets, and reviews that you feel the same way too. I'm excited about the next 20 episodes, and if you're interested in helping to shape those next 20 episodes, then please listen to the outro of these episodes because I have three questions for you, and I would love to hear your thoughts. I'm also excited about this episode because my guest was on the top of my dream list of people to have on a show even before I got started, so I'm really excited that she agreed to be my guest. Beth Comstock is the vice chair and most senior woman in one of the world's biggest companies, General Electric, which is also known as GE. GE was founded over 130 years ago by the inventor of the light bulb, Thomas Edison. It has today over 300,000 employees around the world and makes more than $120 billion in revenues. Today, GE is known for a broad range of products and businesses, for example, for making jet engines for airplanes, medical equipment like the MRI, and lighting products. At GE, Beth is responsible for market development, for marketing, and for taking the GE story about innovation and new businesses into the world. In our conversation, Beth shares a ton of really great advice, like, for example, how she learned how to ask for help, her thoughts about how to build an effective network, both internally and externally, how to ask for and become open for receiving feedback, how she defines success, how she makes decisions about how she spends her time, and many, many more great nuggets of wisdom from an amazing career in business. You'll hear a bunch of sirens in the episode. Apologies for that, but this is your added little bonus of recording an episode in the middle of New York City. We have some patrons to thank today. This is Megan Quinn, Anna Carolina, and Tim Herbig. You can find the organizations that they support in the show notes. And if you want to make a contribution yourself to make this podcast possible, you can do that by going to patreon.com/role models. This is the Role Models Podcast. My name is David, and this is episode 20. And enjoy learning a thing or two from my guest, Beth Comstock.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks, David.
When Isabel, who I co-created Role Models with as an event series back in Berlin 2 years ago, when we were sitting down and discussing turning this idea of a podcast into reality, you were one of the names that I wanted to have on the
Thank you.
Podcast. So I really appreciate your time. It's a Saturday. You just came back from Australia. So I really appreciate your time. And I'm really excited about having you as a guest.
Thank you. I'm really excited we could do it.
Yeah. Beth, your Twitter bio says that you are a curious and collaborative leader. And I wanted to know, maybe kick off this episode with a question around what are you most curious about? And it cannot be work-related.
Well, I'm just curious about everything. I think that's part of my challenge, I think, and also part of what gets me up every morning is I just love to learn. If there's something I haven't discovered, I love to be on top of it. Right now, I'm incredibly curious about philosophy. I studied more science when I was in school, and I did a little bit of liberal arts, but I didn't really do history or philosophy. And I find just with the chaotic, crazy times we live in, with such challenge of change, there's something very comforting about classic wisdom, about people who've just thought deeply about our purpose, who we are, what's our place in the world. So of late, I've been incredibly curious about philosophy.
What are some of the things that you read around philosophy?
Well, mostly I've been listening to podcasts, to be honest. They're good, snackable, on the go. There's a BBC series that I love that digs deep into just different philosophers and has these very official sounding British philosophy professors. It's almost like you can only study philosophy either from Germans or British people, and so they just make it sound extra smart. So that's a lot of what I've been listening to, and I've just been reading, you know, Seneca is something I just finished reading, you know, sort of on living and,
the Stoics.
There was a great book I read, called Swerve, which was all about, the discovering of Lucretius and how he almost went unfound. And so just people recommend things and I pick them up. So it's a lot of self-study.
I want to go back to the early days to help our listeners understand your background. Can you share a little bit about where you grew up and how it was to grow up where you grew up?
I grew up in a small town in Virginia, a town called Winchester, Virginia, in the heart of the Shenandoah, the top of the Shenandoah Valley. Very lovely. Now it's a much bigger town than when I grew up, but it was a very nurturing kind of community. My parents, my mother was a teacher, my father was a local dentist, and we were just sort of had our roots in that town. And my mother knew everything and everybody in the town. It was the kind of place where my mother knew what I was going to do before I even contemplated doing it. So she was very well networked. And so I couldn't get away with much because my mother's little network was always on the watch. But it was just a very sort of picturesque, kind of charming life growing up, to be honest.
What would you say were some of the early influences that have shaped who you are today? Like maybe people or maybe things that have influenced you?
Well, I think certainly my parents. I see in my mother being this very networked person. I don't come naturally to that, but I've seen her, just her drive and her ability to connect with people. I mean, there's no one my mother hasn't met that she won't be able to find everything about their entire life. She just bonds with people. So I've been able to observe that. My father is more artistic. He's on his third career now. He is actually an artist now. He's a ceramicist and makes all kinds of amazing pieces of art. So I think I was able to be influenced both sides of my brain that way. And I think that small town, in some ways, I take with me. I think that sort of grassroots feeling of know who you are, know where you came from. My parents both came from small towns themselves. So I think that sort of ethos has influenced myself, my brother, my sister. So I definitely know I take that with me. I never would have imagined I'd work for one of the biggest companies on earth and be able to go to the places around the world I have and experience the difference in the way I have, given where I came from. But I think that also is what fueled me to go forward, to think this is a great place to learn and discover. There has to be more.
And what was the decision to go into science?
Well, I think maybe when I was getting ready to go away to college, I wanted to be a doctor. I really wanted to be a psychologist, but a doctor, you know, a medical doctor, a physician seemed like the thing to do. So I went away to school and studied biology, thinking I was going to go to medical school. But what I loved most of all was anthropology and just studying the way people behave and understanding different societies and what people do. So I think early on I saw those seeds of just sort of behavior and trying to understand why people do what they do.
You're someone who appears to say yes to many things. Maybe I'm jumping a little bit ahead, but where do you think this comes from? I mean, when you said yes to coming on a show, that was a great deal. That was a big deal for me. And so what is the thing, like, where does this drive come from?
It's a good question. I was just having this discussion with my husband recently, not always in a good context, because what it means is I often sign up for more than I have time for. My appetite is often bigger than my capacity. And it's that discovery passion, I think, just to sort of connect in new ways, be part of a new experience. I have over time built a network of great people who I have great respect for. That's how you and I got connected. And so when someone says to me, hey, you need to spend time with David, and it's someone I know and respect, I go, okay, I'm going to take note. So, but mostly I think it's just, again, back to this curiosity and this discovery mode of wanting new experiences.
How have you developed over time some sort of, because you need to find a way to like sustain that, right? Over, I mean, you have a busy job for one of the largest companies in the world, as you described it. And so how have you developed, is it more of a flow, or is it something where you have developed a practice of deciding how you spend your time and where and which exciting opportunities to pursue and which one to say, hey, I'm going to put these on pause for a moment?
Yeah, it's such a good question. It's so relevant. I've been thinking about that. I just got back from, as you said, a long trip in Australia, part work, and I took a few days vacation. And, you know, when you sort of take that time and you stop, it makes you very reflective. So the way I look at, I'm constantly evaluating how I spend my time and always asking, am I spending my time in the right ways? To me, it's sort of a Venn diagram of three bubbles, if you will. One is the stuff I have to do. Like, you know, there's certain things you just have to do. Then I kind of have two other bubbles of the stuff I hate to do. I mean, there's stuff I just don't like to do, but I have to do it, or, you know, usually those intersect. And then there's the stuff I love to do. And so it's a constant tension to me of trying to get things more into the love to do bucket. And the perfect intersect is the have to do and have to do, love to do. And so a lot of times it's, that's part of the filter. Is this something that is worth, that I want to spend my time? Do I have to do it, or do I want to do it?
What do you do with the bubble that says the hate to do?
Well,
how do you approach that?
I try to make sure it's something that I can get my head around. I mean, like, I don't naturally like working out. I'm not, but I try to find something I like that is a little bit more of the, it could be a hate to do, but I have to do it. It's good for my health. It makes me feel better. So let's find something I love to do. So I love kickboxing, not running.
Yeah. So you, kickboxing is your thing?
Kickboxing is my thing. I can do a mean roundhouse, but it takes a lot of energy. I think that's one of the other filters that you have to consider when you're figuring out how do I spend my time. Just because I love to do it, it can take a lot of your energy. Stuff that you really don't like to do takes a lot of negative energy, yeah. And the stuff you love to do gives you a certain energy. So I try to balance, and the things you don't like to do, I mean, you try to find if there's someone else that can do it. It's outsourcing. I mean, thank goodness there are a lot of people who like to do a lot of different things that, you know, I don't like to do my taxes. Luckily, I can find someone to help me do my taxes. So yeah, things like that.
Maybe your hate circle is somebody's love circle.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Exactly. And that's a beautiful match. That's what collaboration is all about. But I do think when you're picking your time, I find myself, I sometimes have to say, one, I've done that before, so do I need to do it again? With the teams I work with, often something or an invitation will come and I'll go, okay, either I've done that before, do I have to, or is this really the best for me to go? Is this a better opportunity for someone else to explore? So you constantly have to ask, okay, just because it came in, are you the right person? Is this the right time? So I have quite a filter I go through to figure out where to put my energy. But in the end, I always say yes to too many things because my appetite is just much bigger than reality.
So you studied biology, but your first foray into the business world had nothing to do with biology, is correct?
Well, my first foray into working was I wanted to be a reporter. And so that's how I sort of went forth in the world. I was not a very good journalist, as it turned out. I wasn't very confident. My first foray, I did an internship in radio, and then I went to work for a TV news service, and it covered Virginia politics, very far from science.
Why do you say you weren't good at it?
Because I wasn't. I mean, it was just clear I wasn't.
What was the things that were not good?
Well, I was self-conscious. I had studied biology. I didn't have any sort of training. You know, I worked in my college at the local TV station, local radio, done internships, but I hadn't been skilled in it. And I wanted to be a science reporter. That was what I had decided. That's what I want. I want to tell stories about science. And I just never quite got those two. I did one piece when I worked as an intern in public radio, interviewed my science professor at College of William & Mary. That was about as close as I ever got to it. So that put me on a path into media. And next thing you know, I'm sort of behind the scenes in media and realizing there's a whole world of roles I had no idea existed, and got me into more promotion, communications, marketing.
Take us through that journey a bit, through your career. Talk briefly about the first couple of stations in your career.
Well, the one of the very first, I covered Virginia State politics, and it was a very small news service. Their contract was literally to cover the House of Delegates of the Commonwealth of Virginia, and it was like a 6-month assignment. And I was camera person, reporter, technician. There were three of us. It was actually a great learning experience. At night, I worked in a restaurant because it didn't pay a lot. And there was something when you look back, there's at the time you think, oh, I'm, you know, this is it. But when you look back, there's something almost romantic about that period of time, because so much possibility that you don't appreciate at that time.
When you say it's romantic, did you ever go back to a restaurant? Does it still exist?
I don't think the restaurant exists. It was in Richmond, Virginia. I don't think, and that part was probably less romantic than the day job. But it was the teamwork, you know, and it enabled me to be able to spend the days doing what I liked. But the working, covering the House of Delegates and learning how to register a camera and what's a grayscale and these nerdy kind of things that I had never learned. Again, it was back to learning.
So reporting reporting about politics, did you sometimes felt an itch to go into politics?
No.
Or was it you were always more interested in the media side of things?
Always more interested in media side of things.
Why not politics?
It never interested me. I don't, I mean, since then, I think I've become much more civically engaged. But at that time in my life, I was just more interested in telling the story, not being the story.
What were some of the things that you've learned at that time that you would still apply today?
Well, I think one of the things I learned was about perseverance, because I was using that was a starting point, and I wanted to go work at a local television station. And I remember there was a station I worked in Richmond, Virginia. That was would have been a big market at that point for someone like me. And I kept sending my tapes to this news director, and he would just not take my call. And I would call him at least once a week, and then it started to be once a day, and it really brought out a tenacity in me I don't think I knew I had. And I finally, he picked up the phone one day and he was like, "Would you stop calling me?"
So he knew who you were.
Yeah, yeah. "I'm never going to hire you. Yes, I've looked at your tape. You're too young. You look like a kid on television. I'm never going to hire you. Stop calling me." And I think I was speechless. I probably just said, "Okay, thank you," and hung up the phone. But it really stuck with me. And in my head, he became this character of Mr. Rant, and sort of this, like, I'm gonna do it. I'm not going to let Mr. Rant define me. And it sort of brought out this tenacity that I didn't know I had.
Do you have, I want to maybe take this into present time, because have you ever been on that side of the phone, of someone being very perseverant and not giving up? And because I think with today's technology, with email, with all the different channels, all the inbound, all the ways to reach out to you, you must receive a lot of inbounds. And so how do you view now people who are perseverant, and when is it too much? Yeah. At what point does it become too much?
It's a good question. I do hear from people. I actually like hearing from people. I don't have opportunity to respond to everybody, but I do respond to many people that I hear from, especially people from inside my company or people looking for advice. I think people who are very thoughtful, they have a point of view, or they have a suggestion and they're, you know, looking for advice. The ones that are just like, you know, what do you think I should do? Well, I don't know you. It's hard for me to respond. But I love people I work with who are persevering. I love that. I, in fact, think there is a role for people in any organization, sort of the figure it out role. And I think that's almost a test you give to people unwittingly to just say, you know, can you just without a lot of direction. I work in a lot of strategy, vague, what's new, what's next, and there isn't a roadmap. So it's that perseverance to just keep figuring it out. For example, blockchain is something we've had a team on, and the people who can do that job are very different often than the people who can do a core operating job. And it's that perseverance you're testing for.
If you would break it down to a trainable skill, what would that skill be?
The perseverance or the figure it out or both?
Both.
Yeah. Well, I think the perseverance is you just, first, I think it breaks down to you see something that catches your attention. There's something going on here. I have a 3-time rule. It's not very scientific, but first time I see something, I'm constantly filtering, exposing myself to a lot. First time I see something, I go, huh, that's interesting. Second, huh, is that a coincidence? Isn't that interesting? I'm seeing it again in a different context. Third time, pattern recognition. Third time for me, you know, it's the old 3 dots make a line. So I go, I need to look into that. So I think people who can appreciate patterns, they see something. And then you see a way forward. You see, in the context of I work for GE, I see blockchain technology. It's not about us using Bitcoin. It's about, wow, this technology can really help us in this age of connected devices. Potentially, this is a way for machines to talk to machines. And you see it, then you have to go figure it out. So that's the kind of perseverance and the kind of skill I think that people, not everybody has it, but I think everybody can. One, open yourself up to see patterns. And two, you see something that you just can't get out of your brain. You just can't give up. There's something here. And it just bugs you. And so you have to keep going on it. That's where the perseverance comes from. I think you either see a better way, you're trying to solve a problem and you think you have a solution, or you're just darn curious and you can't give up on it.
And then they're figuring out, do you apply a process? Have you adopted a process or a framework or a model, mental model, how you figure things out?
Yeah, now that you're asking me, I probably should have one, but I think for me, it's just a lot of iteration. It's a lot of continuing to sort through it. It's a lot of speaking out loud. I've learned in the early stages, I'll show up to people, and you know, I do this a lot with my boss. I'll show up and I'll go, look, a drone. And he goes, that's a cartoon. What are you doing? What, that means nothing here. A drone? What do I care about a drone? Well, I don't know. Let me go, and I go away and I'll do some, oh, look at what this drone can do. It can deliver medicine to remote parts of the world. So it's continuing to iterate and find a story and a way to communicate what you've found. And then I think the next step is to start to create action around it. Okay, what do we do with it? That's interesting. Where I think often people who are looking to what's next, they go, interesting, but they don't stop to translate it. So then I think the next job is, how do we make that relevant? Oh, let's find some applications here where I work. Okay, drone. We're going to use drone. You know, drone with a camera could start to survey a railroad line. Is there a test we want to run with a railroad customer? So that's a lot of how I try to then turn it into a small action that then you ask, can this go bigger?
I want to pause there because this is interesting, and it's a bit, a few conversations I've had over the past few weeks is people who feel stuck in a career, right? Or say, I'm really unhappy about where I am right now, and I would much rather prefer to do something else, but there's all these powers at play in my head and elsewhere, coming from elsewhere, that are preventing me from doing that. When you say, and it's often people who have an idea about how they might be happier and another thing they would be doing. And so to your point around breaking it into an action, like what is your advice you can share around taking this idea or these voices in your head or these doubts that you have or these powers at play, internal or external, to turn it into an action to overcome that?
Well, the first thing is we all have those voices in our heads, those questions. I think at least most people I've encountered do. I know I do. And so the first thing is, I think you just have to stop for a minute and go, okay, I can't deal with all these. Let me sort of sequentially go through those questions. Which of those are worries versus real? And then what, just can I take one step? Can I just take one step to see if this is a viable path, to see if I'm good at this, to see if I can actually prove my way? And I think often we talk ourselves out of it. I often see people I work with, they're like, oh, my boss just won't let me do that. Well, did you ask? No, but I know she won't let me do it. But you didn't ask. And it's, well, I hear a lot from people inside and outside of the of GE saying, I want to be more entrepreneurial. I work a lot with entrepreneurs, and it sounds, you know, it sounds very exciting. You don't have a boss, but even entrepreneurs have bosses. They have funders, or they have boards of directors.
Customers,
yeah. Exactly. So, you know, you sort of go through, okay, but can you be entrepreneurial in where you are first? Can you prove, you know, there's sort of, to me, it comes back to, in many cases, just being the entrepreneur of your job. And for me, I think I've always tried to go for the job that no one else wants or sees possible and prove myself a bit entrepreneurial in what I've been given to do as almost a test to myself that there's something here that I can create. So that's often what I'll say to people is, can you just start where you are?
What is one job that you saw that nobody else wanted to do that maybe didn't appear as glamorous, where you would go back and say, that looked like the least glamorous thing and the thing that would probably not help me progress in my career, but it eventually did? Can you describe?
Many jobs I've had that way, but I would say one that stands out for me was mid-career. I was working in media, and at the time I was at CBS doing entertainment publicity, and NBC News had had some challenges. Basically the whole division was almost cleaned out because of a integrity issue, and they were looking to bring new people in, and it was a job that no one wanted. It was a job that had been unfilled, and they called me, and I'd been at NBC, left, and they said, do you want to come back? And it was a job literally that looked like the worst job on earth at that time.
Were you scared?
I was scared, but I think I was excited because it was a challenge. It was, there's nowhere to go but up. And I think I saw this opportunity to be part of something that potentially could be recreated. To me, that untapped a real entrepreneurial spirit that I'm forever grateful I had. I worked with a great, at the time, Andy Lack, who's now the chairman of NBC News, was at that time the head of NBC News, and he was a great role model, leader, encouraged the team to think they could win again. And I was able to create a team. So I looked to that opportunity, and it's just informed me, and there was nowhere to go but up. And so, when I came to the GE side of the company and was asked by Jeff Immelt to take on marketing, again, people think, oh, marketing, you know, you just do the advertising. Well, I saw marketing as about change and innovation. This is marketing is about where the markets are, and let's take a different approach. So I think if you can harness that within yourself, probably any job is open for reinvention.
How do you, like, for people who hear this and to say, hey, cool, I get this. What is advice you can share with them to actually go and do that, to look for these opportunity, to look for these things that are maybe less glamorous and to find a way to turn it into an opportunity, turn into something positive? What is a practical thing people can do?
Well, the first thing I think is you have to see it. I mean, I wouldn't just sign up for a bad job just because you think, hey, this is a chance. I mean, you have to have a passion for it. You have to have a vision. Hey, I see something here. Huh, marketing. Well, yeah, it's about advertising, but, you know, let me think about that. It's really about going where customers are. It's about change. I think I can see a different path forward. I think you have to have a willing partner in that, somebody that believes in your vision. So you almost have to be able to sell that story to someone. So that would be where I would start is, do you see something? Are you passionate about it? And then can you convince at least one other person? It doesn't have to be the manager. It can be a colleague that this is a good idea.
How do you know that you're picking the right thing?
Well, you never know.
You never know.
I actually am a bit torn in my own mind. I believe you can make it better, right? So there's a little bit of you making it better. there's also, we've all been in assignments where, I've been in assignments where it was just a bad time. The team, the mode wasn't right. And I also know there are times when you sort of have to say, okay, I got to fold. This is not right. But I think for me, because I try to be tenacious, I want to give it a couple of good goes before I give up on things. I see a lot of people who come in with a business pitch. I've seen this with entrepreneurs. I've seen this with full-scale companies. They come in with a pitch for an idea. Someone says no, and they walk away, and they never come back again. Wow, what a missed opportunity. And there's a point when if you keep coming back forever and ever and you're not getting anywhere, maybe you should fold. But too many times people give up too early.
Talk a bit about the act of asking for help. And the reason I ask is because it came up in a conversation I recently have, and the person said that the fear that person had of asking for help was that it was a demonstration of a weakness. And I was curious to hear how do you view this? Like, how do you see asking for help? How do you ask for help effectively? What's your experience there?
Yeah, boy, that's such a good question. I think I have changed dramatically in that area, but I still struggle with it. I think sometimes it's, yes, you think, well, I'm supposed to have this idea and it has to be brilliantly conceived and constructed and it has to be fully baked before I can put it in the world. So you put a lot of pressure on yourself. Whereas I've learned the reality is a seed of an idea is really all you need to get started. And in fact, the best ideas are collaboration and other people put their opinions forth and people like being asked to help you. Most people do. So I think there's that part of, there is a bit of belief, especially around ideas. I'm supposed to have all the ideas. So there's a bit of perfectionism, pressure, ego, perhaps that comes in there. To me, there's also another part sometimes where you don't want to bother people. And I suffer from that a lot where, it's a confidence thing. It's a not wanting to ask. And that is back to if you believe in this, then it naturally takes you to ask for help. Do I really believe this is a problem that needs to be solved? Do I know I can't solve it alone? And I think that is work. I think it's personal life. I mean, I think I have two daughters. I have a great husband. We've had to learn how to ask each other for help. And in those early days, I see myself like stewing and getting frustrated because I didn't ask for help and I didn't get it. Was I expecting someone to read my mind? So I think that's something, if I could go back in time and take that with me to an earlier day, I definitely would have asked for help. But even now, it's either I don't fully know what I'm asking, so I'm afraid a little bit. There's a fear, like I'm not exactly sure. So often what I'll say is, hey, I don't know if this is a good idea, but here's the problem I'm trying to solve. Here's an idea. What do you think? So I kind of couch it a little bit. So I'm maybe protecting myself not to say, hey, this is the best idea you've ever heard. Let's go. And also just giving an invitation to say, let's do this together. I think it's more fun that way.
Yeah, it's this counterintuitive thing about leadership, right? Like we have this idea sometimes that a leader is supposed to have all the answers or to be competent in every dimension of their of the business, whereas actually it's about assembling, you know, the smartest people around the idea, around the problem, and going and solving it. And I think it's a difficult line to dance between this thing like, yeah, I'm competent in my job as a leader, but I also need a lot of expert help for the things that I don't know. And I think navigating that, I found that super, super difficult.
It's you're raising a point. I was in a situation recently, a couple years ago, with a team I worked with. And often I'll say to the people in the group, you know, here's a thought. What do you think? And it's funny. Some people sometimes think like, well, you should have the answers. Why are you asking me? And other people feel on the spot, like, is she grilling me? So you also have to set that environment up front that just says, you know, I don't have all the answers. Here's a starting point. As part of this group, we're all in this together. And when I ask you, what do you think? I really mean, what do you think? Not like, you know, trying to grill you. So I think a leader has to also set that environment and maybe even in the beginning come up with some running rules or some rules of engagement from the beginning to say, this is the way I work.
You mentioned confidence earlier. How did you cultivate your own confidence?
Well, in some ways, I still struggle with it. I mean, I've been working a while, I've been around a while, and I think it's just a constant, for me, just a constant little, one of those little voices in your head that just says, huh, really? Do you really think you can do this? I don't know if it's genetic. I don't know. But how did I get over it? I mean, partly it's just putting myself out there. I'm a more reserved person. I score introvert on all the different tests. And, you know, being introverted, being shy, reserved, they're different things. But it combined with a lack of confidence, it's you know, I know very confident, they're very extroverted people. Maybe they're not confident, but they put themselves out. For me, it's always been an extra step. So, but that was the first thing I had to do. Just put yourself out there. Just meet one person. Just try this one thing. Try it small enough. I think a lot of what we've tried to adopt in GE is this sort of fail fast. You know, it's sort of the entrepreneurial lean startup method, fail small, fail fast. I mean, no one really likes to fail, but if you at least just try it and you do it in a small scale, the failure is less painful. So, okay, you might have gone up to somebody in an event and said, "Hi, I'm Beth. How are you?" And they walked away like you're a weirdo. Is that the worst thing that can happen? And you got to learn to laugh at yourself a little bit. And you meet the first one. Oh, you're David. Great. Okay. Now next time I'm going to go meet two people. And so it's that kind of just almost like behavioral modification. You just keep pushing. Just push yourself a little bit out of the comfort, just a little bit more.
Yeah, it's I like the what's the worst that it can happen. I've tried to apply this as a test now for many of the things that I'm facing, and it's funny how when you really ask that question, it turns out the thing that's the worst that can happen is actually not that bad, and so anything above that is good.
And it helps when you've failed a few of those times, because then you can look back and go, see. I had a really tough assignment about a decade ago. I was my last time at NBC, and it was a really chaotic time, and a few things didn't work out. And I remember thinking at the time, "Oh, this is what you know. What am I doing this for?" And now, in hindsight, I'm like, "Oh, thank goodness I had that experience. You see, this wouldn't have happened, and that wouldn't have happened, and I wouldn't have had this point of view." So sometimes you have to have had a few of those to go back and go, "See, you did get something out of that."
Was there ever a moment when you looked into the mirror and said, I'm actually good at this. In whatever dimension of success that you choose, you decided I'm successful.
Yes and no. I think there's a continual learning of yearning of yes, but. But I would say maybe it's not looking in the mirror. It's sitting around with a team. I mean, to me, that is when I am in my flow. When I'm working with a group of people and we're in the middle of a project and we're improvising and one's building on the other. And like, I can sit at that moment and go, wow, this is going well. I love this moment.
Yeah,
so great. I love that. I mean, and actually I crave those situations. That's when if I could hold a mirror up in that moment, that would be that moment.
How do you define success?
To me, success is setting a goal. Could be a very small goal, could be a very big goal, and achieving it. But what the asterisk on that, achieving it, is often what you achieve isn't necessarily where you started. You might have a desire. I think saying I want to be successful is probably a hard thing to achieve. What outcome do you want to create? What are you trying to accomplish? So I've tried to take that pressure off. Like, I want to be successful. What does that mean? I want to help create a, you know, marketing function that is like no other marketing function. Or, you know, that has a bit more of a tangible outcome than I think just saying I want to be successful. So I think you have to set your sights a bit more realistically.
You are now the vice chair at GE, and you're the first woman to hold this position. What is the importance to you on that? What is the history of that? Like, can you take us behind the scenes of how this came to be?
Well, GE's 130 plus year old company, found in early roots in the days of Thomas Edison and the light bulb and power generation. So we've been around a while. We've seen a lot of change. I often say you don't get to be a company of this age if you don't know how to change. But one of the things that hadn't been part of it was, you know, having more diverse points of view and into the leadership mix. And so to me, it's a sign of a different kind of success for the company that they've found a way to make different mindsets part of the leadership equation. That is important, I think. And I also think for me, having someone with my kind of background and this kind of difference, not just as a female, but as a thinker. I mean, I tend to be more of the sort of ambiguous, what's next, innovator kind of mold, I guess, and less the big scale operator. And so I think there's a sign to say we need different people with different capabilities as well.
How do you describe, how can people imagine the work you do in your current role?
Yeah, it's a good question. I often get people saying, well, what do you do? I don't get what you do. And partly that's by design. It's because it's just constantly looking and evaluating and understanding what's happening in the world. So you're constantly looking at new things. But at the core of it is really just going into markets, understanding what our customers and our industries are seeing change happen, and then translate it. What does that mean? Okay, it means can you start a new business from that insight? Can you seed a business inside the company? Can you partner with a entrepreneur, a startup, to make something happen? So often you're working with people who've already started a new company and you're helping them scale. Does it mean you launch a new product? Can you help your business unit come up with a new product because of that? I'll give you a good example. A decade ago, it was seeing clean technology, a path forward with renewable energy as a path forward for a company like GE. And 10 years later, that's still being a really important offering, an important part of how we do product development at the company. So it's that kind of action. It's a bit ambiguous. So it's not a clear, you make this, you go sell this. It's a lot of finding these trends, dissecting them, and then trying to create products and offers around them.
How large are the different divisions or organizations? Like after how many people do you look after?
It depends on how you look at it. I mean, I'll sort of divide it into three buckets of where I focus. To me, it's sort of three. I focus on what's called business innovation. So it tends to be what's new, what's next, or how do we transform? The first bucket is really market development. It's really that what's new, what's next. And I'd say right now it's in two areas. One is a ventures group that's looking at seeding businesses or partnering with startups, often investing or creating new businesses together. That one's, you know, I think people understand that. And then we're also trying to transform our oldest business, our lighting business, in the connected era, you know, the Internet of Things era. So that's taking the oldest business and reinventing it with new technology and a new business model and serving new customers. So often when something has to be reconfigured, it comes through the teams I work with.
How can we imagine your day? Like, how deep do you go into those topics? Or is it, do you hover more on the idea level, strategy level? Or how deep do you like to go? And how do you balance between these different buckets?
Yeah. So the one bucket is the market development. The second bucket is more sales and marketing. How do sales teams go after new ways of selling? And then the third is storytelling and brand building. And I'd say each of them, I tend to go really deep on the things that are new, the things we're seeding. So for example, with lighting, the lighting transformation, when we were looking, okay, we have this 140-year-old lighting business, what are we going to do? A lot of very deep strategy, who's going to lead what, business reviews every week in some cases. Once the effort gets up and going and you've got a good leader who's helping it go forward, I tend to then hover a bit more. I tend to ask questions. I tend to push on the strategy, focus on the things that need attention. And I do that in the other buckets of what I do. So I often say to teams I work with, in the beginning, I'm going to be very hands-on. You'll probably think I'm a micromanager because we're learning together. I don't know. We're learning. Let's figure this out. And then once we sort of have a plan, you go, you tell me when you need help, and I'll create some sort of momentum for us to come together on a regular basis. But that tends to be the way I work.
What do you think makes a good leader? Or maybe asked differently, how would the people who work closely with you, how would they describe you as a leader?
Well, I think they would hopefully they would describe me as collaborative, as curious. Those are two words that are very important to me. I think they would describe me as having a point of view, a vision of where we're going. So I think that's what leaders have to do. Like, here's where we're going. Leaders then have to get out of the way and say, you have to help us get there. Call me when you need help. So hopefully that's what you would hear from people. I think where I've gotten feedback that things that maybe I'm not aware of that I've needed to be is I tend to like pretty much any idea that comes to me, I'll listen to it, and I fall in love with a lot of ideas easily and fast. And the teams, I think, get a little fatigued because it's like, hey, this is exciting, this is exciting, this is exciting. And people can't go explore everything, and maybe they don't have the same passion for the new that I do. So that's something I've had to work on, to prioritize, to say, okay, I'm going to hold this back. Now's not the time.
Is there a, you mentioned it as an I, like very a dominant I in the personality test. Is that a dominant N as well?
Yes. INTJ is my Myers-Briggs.
Yeah. Getting excited about new ideas and pursuing new ideas. Cool. The act of leadership, right? What are some of the mistakes that you've done as a leader?
And
what can you share with people about how to approach making mistakes and how to over, like how to brush them off and move on and continue?
Personally, I think the best leaders I've worked with are the ones that are most self-aware, and that's something I've had tried to work really hard at, just to be honest and aware, and try to create that honesty with the teams you work with to say, here's what we know, here's what we don't know, here's what we have to figure out. I think that kind of honesty, back to what we said earlier, you can't know it all. We're going to learn together. So I think setting that up, and I think just an honesty of saying to people, we didn't get that right. And shouldering that too. I led us down that path. I put too many things on your plate. No wonder we couldn't get that done. I had you look at 5 things when you only had the bandwidth to look at 2. I hold myself responsible for that. So I think that kind of shouldering the burden, being able to say that to your team is important, to be able to say, I messed up, I didn't get that right. So I think those are the things I've had to be sure I do. One of the things I've gone to lately is just asking for tons of feedback. And I've been asking, tell me one thing I don't want to hear. Tell me what I don't want to hear. And usually people are put off by that question, so you got to give them in advance, okay, and you're coming back tomorrow, and I want you to tell me one thing that you think I could have done differently or could have helped this that I didn't do. And so that's something I've had to ask for the feedback to, because sometimes you're failing in ways you don't even know. The team doesn't want to tell you. For example, one of the things the teams I work with, one of them came back and said, well, people just do stuff because they say, well, Beth wants this done. But I never said I wanted that done. So that was my failure to communicate that, So things like that, if you don't know that, how are you ever going to fix it?
Is there a tool or a model how to become more self-aware? Like what have you found to be working for you?
Just one thing, you just have to ask questions.
Ask questions.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Ask questions. I mean, in New York, the mayor of the 70s, Ed Koch, would always go around, how am I doing? I mean, it sounds kind of weird, but I think without being totally insecure, how am I doing? How are we doing? What could we be doing better? I think those should be part of your constant questions and toolkit. And then I think you have to stop and go, is that right? What if that's right? You can't be defensive. I know early on, we all get defensive, but I know I was defensive early on because it's back to that perfectionist thing. One of the things that helped me tremendously, and this is a real gift, and G does this at certain stages in your career where they do these 360 reviews. And I mean, it's like an autopsy. It's just a living autopsy. In this case, they interviewed like 30 people. They went back to like high school teachers. I mean, this was while I was already working in the company, and they just went back to really understand who are you and what makes you tick. One, it was just a gift to be able to have a, you know, that kind of curiosity about a person. And then they ask your teams and peers the good and the bad. And then to have that, you know, it's sort of a nurturing environment. We want to know about you. But then to have that, and you're on the hook for it. You got to say, I heard you. Wow, I heard you. And I remember at that time, some of the feedback was I wasn't asking for help. I was trying, working too hard to get the idea done and make it fully baked. And I was abrupt. And people thought I was maybe rude because I was abrupt. Well, I could have fought that. I could have said, they're wrong. You know, do they know how hard it is here? I have to work. I had to go, you know what? These are people I trust. I need these people. I need to be better. And the first thing I did after that was I remember sitting around a table with the team and saying, I can do better. You've said I'm abrupt. Help me. Can you, next time you see me do that, can you go remember that abrupt thing? That was an example. You'll help me. And so I think that's being self-aware is just one, it's an admission that I have work to do on myself and I need your help.
That's great advice. It takes a bit of courage to ask that, right? Ask for these things that are maybe blind spots or things that could at first come across as a bit like an attack and to find a way to deal with it. I've read somewhere that you are the most networked person within GE. And this probably goes back to you describing yourself as a collaborative leader. And I was curious if we could maybe spend a few minutes on unpacking or breaking down collaboration and effective collaboration and networking in the company. So for people who are early in their careers who maybe have a very maybe narrow job, which they as an individual contributor are pursuing, but have ambitions or desires to broaden out their skill sets or to eventually maybe even take on leadership positions. What have you found in your career to be effective ways to network internally to become a good collaborator?
Yeah, I actually think I've in my career been better, certainly my GE career, been better networking outside the company than I have in. That's one of those things I had to address at some point to go, okay, I'm good. I actually saw a need. I saw in the company a lot of great networking inside, but maybe there wasn't as much outside. So that was a way to differentiate myself, find insights, add value. When people hear networking, I don't know, I often thought it sounded really cheesy, like, you know, something you go in, you're like, hey, how you doing? Take their business card and like you check it off, like we're done. That's not good networking to me. I think to me, again, network is about curiosity. It's about what can I learn from this person? And so for anyone starting their business career, I think the networking helps you get to be more effective. I often say to people, not just, hi, David, you know, what do you do? Just tell me your story. What are you passionate about these days? What trends are you seeing in the marketplace that are interesting to you? So one, I'm learning about you, but I'm also gathering. So I think that's some of what you're trying to do. The next stage of networking, I think, is value exchange. It's not just, hi, you're David, here's your story, but it's, what problems are you trying to solve? Oh, that's interesting. My company's trying to solve that problem together too. Maybe there's something we should stay in touch about. Or that's interesting. Huh. I may know somebody who can help you think that through. So try to connect the dots for people. And then translate those insights back to, is there something relevant? So to me, a good network is about value exchange. It's like, yeah, we want to connect. It may not be that there's business to be transacted right that minute. And I think that's where people often, they'll say, well, is it worth my time? Should I go and meet these people because I've got work to do? I say it has to be part of your work. So if I were starting out and you want to get good at an area, build a network in that area. If you're an accountant, if you're an economist, if you're a product development person, okay, product development, I want to get really good at user experience. Well, how are you going to get good at that? You got to go meet people who go to a few conferences, go to, you know, meetups where people are discussing it, meet a few people. Ask them what they do. Stay in touch. You don't have to like call each other every week, but every now and then, what are you hearing? What are you seeing? It's a way, I guarantee you those, maybe 20% of those connections will be something you'll be really glad you had.
Now you have, I assume and maybe imagine that you have a super large network. And so to the point of cultivating that or maintaining it, sustaining it, do you have any tips on, so you said that, you know, stay in touch. Like, do you have a system in place on how do you stay in touch with certain people? Or is this more of a fluid thing? Because I think like in my networking, I always find it a bit challenging, maybe even to the point of being overwhelming of now you've met all these, you know, you've met 100 people a year or maybe even more. And how do you stay on top of that?
Well, I think it is more fluid. I don't think you can, you know, I don't certainly have a, you know, a CRM system for my network, a customer relationship management, network relationship management, although maybe there's an idea there for a business or some sort of software or something. Maybe there is something that should be done.
Business idea.
Exactly. There we go. NRM, network relationship management. But I think it's, you just, when you see something interesting, you'll share it. You know, hey, David, I was thinking of you. I remember you said you were really interested in you know, I know you're in Berlin, and here's somebody new who's coming to Berlin. I'd love for you to meet them. Next time they're in Berlin, I think you'd find something valuable in what they're doing. So I try to, if it's meaningful, I stay connected that way. Or if I have a question to ask, I just, what are you seeing here? So I try to make it meaningful when I stay in touch. And that's, you know, as fluid as it gets. I guarantee you there'll be times when you come back and you'll say, remember we met here and there, you know, can I ask you about X? I find it kind of creepy. And when people sort of come after you've met and they try to do a business deal really fast, I try not to do that. I think I want a connection about interest. And what are you seeing in the world? And if it leads to business, great. But I find that a little creepy sometimes to hit people up too soon.
Yeah, it's a bit more about building a network and relationships before you need them.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. I was curious. So we jumped a bit ahead into GE, but I just want to make sure that you mentioned that you've gotten into you know, into media, into communications, you know. Time at Universal, you helped launch Hulu, or you led the effort to launch Hulu. I was curious to hear about what is, when you look back at these different phases of your career, this arc, like what are the foundational skills that you've transferred from role to role throughout your career that people might, who hear this might go and say, okay, so I want to be one day be the vice chair of GE. What is it going to take?
Well, I think a couple of things. I certainly didn't set out to be the vice chair of GE. I think it was doing these things that led to that. So I think, what are these things? I think it is the ability to see an opportunity and translate it into a story. So I think there's a storytelling part of it. And what is a good story? It's basically, you know, you can see a possibility, you translate it and you tell it in a way that people can relate to it. So I think that sort of communication capability has helped me. There's an identification and a storytelling about it. I think that networking capability to build a network of people and use it to find new trends and themes. And I think it's just that ability to see things differently and not be afraid to sort of say, hey, there's a different path. Let's try it. Let's just give it a shot. Let's try. Those are the things that I think have helped me build a career. I think anybody can do those things. So it's not like some, you know, secret, you know, leadership manual that I got an early copy of. I think it's just the ability to just put yourself out there and to believe that you actually have value in seeing things differently.
You were... You took the role of a CMO at GE after it was vacant for 20 years, and you handed over the reins to your colleague Linda. What is the advice you gave her when she took your role?
That I think she has to do it in her way. She can't run the play I was running. In fact, if if she was just going to do that, then she shouldn't do the job. I should keep doing it. And what I love about Linda is a couple of things. Is she is the most collaborative person I've ever worked with. And so people just naturally like working with her. So I knew she would be good at working with people. But she's very creative, and she's very good at, especially in the digital area of understanding the digitization of industry. And that's been the way she's differentiated, and she's brought marketing forward about user experience. And those were things that needed to happen. So it was also a gap that I hadn't focused on. I had been focusing a little bit more on marketing as an innovation machine. She's looking at it as a bit of how do you engage with customers in new ways, and we needed that. So I think also, as you hand over the reins, somebody has to be able to make sure they're focused on what a need is, not just trying to win awards or, you know, get the best of praise. They have to actually identify a problem and have a path to go forward.
How much has mentorship been an importance, or has it had an importance on your career?
Sure. I mean, every role I've had, I have had people I've looked up to. I tend to gravitate to a sort of board of advisors role. I often have different people that I'm calling on to help me think through different things. Early in my career, I had had a couple of unexpected mentors. I had someone who was a bit critical of me, and we forged a great path, and he was a generation older than me, very, very different, and he became a great mentor to me and the kind of person I could go into, and he'd be like, stop that. You look silly. What you're doing now, you're not coming across as confident. We just had a real trust in that. I've had a mentor who's 10 years younger than me, and she's somebody who just, you know, I've been able to see how she approaches jobs and new opportunities in a way that I never did. And I'll ask her about it and tell. So I think you have to be open to mentorship from different perspectives. It's not always somebody who looks like they're perfect in their job. It can often be people who worked for you, who seem like they would be the least likely person to ask advice for.
How do you establish a mentorship relationship? Like, what is the formal or maybe informal contract that you advise people to do? Or when people reach out to you and say, hey, Beth, I consider you a role model, and I admire you, and I want you to be my mentor. Like, what do you do?
Well, I find that's a lot of pressure, to be honest. Because I think that I just don't believe one person can fulfill everything you're looking to do. So I tend to, when people say that, I mean, let's have a conversation. What problem are you trying to solve? I may not be the best person to help you solve. Can I suggest somebody else who might be? Or, yeah, I can help you think through this. I don't have enough time, or I have time, but I can't get to you. And, you know, so I think appreciate when you're dealing with people, like why you've asked them, not just, I like what you've done in your career, but I get a lot of people who say they identify as introverts. I have a soft spot for that, right? I know what that's like. So they'll often say, here's the problem I'm trying to solve. And if I can't help them, at least I can maybe give them a few thoughts of where they can go to help. So I would say, one, identify the area you think you need help with, or that you're reaching out to that person. Like, why? What can this person really help you do? And I'd also say there's not one person that's going to help. So again, try to find different people and be very clear. I need help with this. I see you're good at that. You overcame that. Can you just tell me how you did it? Maybe an email's fine. Do you have to get on the phone with them for, you know, can you do it in an email? Are there different ways? Can they send you something they've read, that they've written? Maybe they've done something on Medium that you should know about. So I'd say there may be different ways to take in that insight too.
So it's like, even if you have to say no, there's an alternative that you're offering.
Exactly. Yeah.
You talked a few times about introversion, and I find this fascinating, because I identify as a dominant extrovert, very, very clearly, even though I love spending time by myself. A few of the dynamics I've observed over 8 years at SoundCloud as well is that there's a bit of a misconception around introversion and extroversion, particularly when it comes to public speaking or interacting with others. Is that, can you help me understand as an extrovert in a time And in the world and in a business world, it is a lot about public perception and broadcasting a message, broadcasting your personal brand. What advice can you share as a public figure for a large company, but who identifies as an introvert? What advice can you share with people who are earlier in their career who are like, I identify as an introvert and I'm terrified by the idea of going out there? What are ways they can train or learn how to overcome that?
Yeah, I remember my younger daughter, and she was like in grade school, and she came home in tears, and she was like, "I'm so sad. I'm so upset. They called my name on the loudspeaker today and gave me an award, and I'm panicked about it." So it was like that like appreciating that she got the reward, but not wanting the public attention. That's what an introvert feels, right? It's that just pure fear. It's an energy that you have to put yourself out there, and you just don't feel comfortable. It's an energy. I think I've read Susan Cain's book, Quiet. I think that helped me again appreciate there's an energy that it's hard to describe if you're not that person. It just requires extra energy to put yourself out there. So that's the first thing, is just sort of finding the way to harness that energy. I've made it about my job. So to me, it's like business is a more extroverted sport. So if I'm going to be successful in business, I have to figure out how to do this. I saw myself one too many times be the fearful, like wanting them to call my name, but don't call my name, and hold myself back. Or if I say this, they're not going to think I'm afraid to say this. Or what if somebody, there's all sorts of things that come in. So it's holding yourself back. You just have to put yourself out there a little bit. And I think to be good at life, you have to put yourself out there a little bit. So social media, I remember the first time I tweeted, the panic. You probably were like, hey, who cares? I'm just going to put it out there. To me, the sheer panic of hitting that tweet button, just do it, right? One tweet. It's just put yourself out. So after a while, you're able to speak because you get comfortable doing it, but it's a way to be part of the business world, to be part of the network you want to be in. It's a way to participate.
How do you deal with criticism?
That's part of that comes with it. I think you just have to stop and go, okay, is this relevant? What can I learn from this? And if it's not relevant, you just go, okay, that's their opinion. That takes a lot of work to get there. Usually you're like devastated. I think sometimes social media, you set yourself up there. And is somebody trying to be helpful? Are they trying to give me good advice, or are they just trolling? There's a big difference. And I think you have to, realize that there's a difference, and that most people, I think, are trying to help you. And so can I take something from that?
So trying to see through the criticism for something that you can learn from that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other thing I'd say about extrovert, introvert is this is where collaboration comes in. I think some of my best partnerships are recognizing maybe I hold myself back. I need to reserve that energy, and I'm best paired with somebody who puts themselves out. Something really simple. I'll give you an example. Like, I like having dinner parties, but I don't like inviting people. I mean, it sounds so silly. It's almost embarrassing to say that, but I'm putting myself out there a little bit. I've teamed with people who are very extroverted, and they're okay. They don't care, So like, I'm really good at organizing and putting the pieces together. And I have a friend, she's really good at like being out in the world. And so we've put together this really great set of events where we bring people together. And so I think that would be the other thing I'd say to an introvert is find a colleague or a friend or someone that, maybe you round each other out a little bit. And when you're putting the teams together in a group brainstorming, I'll often realize the people who are more introverted, maybe I'll say to them in advance of the meeting, hey, here's something I want you to think about. Could you come to the meeting with that? Or if you're not comfortable, come to me afterwards and tell me what you think about it. So I think there's also a way to let people know of your style, and that maybe you're more comfortable in a different setting, or find a different way after the meeting to say to your team leader, hey, here's an idea. I had a chance to think about it. So I'd also say own a little bit of that and not be afraid of it.
Yeah, I've found interactions with introverts amazingly nourishing, because it's deep thinking happening, and just offers a totally different perspective of where I'm from. So I now go and seek advice from people who identify more as introverts.
We're the ones at the cocktail party that are just, you're like probably we're going to talk to two people the whole night. We're not going to talk to 20. And you're right. We're going to have a longer conversation. I've often said, well, okay, I've taken enough of your time, you know, thank you, because otherwise I'll just stand there and talk to you forever because now we're comfortable. So you also have a responsibility, yeah. I think, sometimes to go, okay.
This podcast is called Role Models, and I was curious, do you have a role model or several role models, and who is it?
I have several role models. I mean, I've mentioned some of them. I tend to think really more of those advisors, a series of advisors. I mean, I've worked for some great bosses that have been role models, Jack Welch, Jeff Immelt, Andy Lack. These are people I've mentioned who have just taken the time to, you know, help me get better. So I'm very appreciative of those kind of people. I've also had bosses who weren't so good, and I learned a lot from those people as well. I have different people I go to, you know, for different advice. Some early days of social media, I went to someone like Soraya Darabi, who we both know, and she helped me, you know, get good in a certain area. So David Kidder, somebody I work with right now, who's a serial entrepreneur, who's helped me think through a couple of ideas about, you know, putting business ideas together. So they're just different people I could point to depending on the problem I'm trying to solve.
If GE's one vice chair Beth could go back to the 16-year-old Beth, what would she say?
I think she would say, at 16, I think I was full of enthusiasm and curiosity for the world. So I think I would go and say, like, hang on to that. That's good. And my second thing I would say is, don't worry so much. Don't worry. Just go with it. The worrying part, I think I would have left at 16. The curiosity, I hope I've brought enough of that forward.
How do you... I worry a lot. What advice do you have for me about dealing with worry?
Well, I've tried to channel my worry. I have an amazing scenario brain. So I try to channel it into thinking through every potential scenario for every potential situation in business. So I've channeled that to good outcomes. Here's five scenarios. So I'd say try to channel some of that energy to say, can I help solve some of the problems I'm thinking through? The second thing I think is sometimes you have to put it in a little box. You just have to think in your head, there's this little box. I can't worry about that right now. I call it my worry box. I'm going to put that worry in my worry box, and I'll come back to it. Sometimes it's 3 a.m. I come back to it, and that's not a good time. But that's another way I try to not let the worry overtake my head.
Mine, a little bit more like a wild animal in it to try to escape that box all the time.
It's like yeah. Scratching.
Nudging and scratching and screaming. Yeah. If you could accelerate one positive change, either in the world or within your area of responsibility, what would that be?
I think that's for both. I wish people would just try more. Just try something. Just give it a shot. Just try it, and not overthink it, and not try to make things perfect. And then maybe my second thing that would lead to the world is, I think there's so many problems that we can come together and solve. So how do we get together? And the collaboration piece, I think, just more people coming together around a shared vision for a good outcome. I think that's what we need in the world right now.
What do you want to be known for?
I want to be known for just somebody that was part of just a great part of a great team, and that we all feel we made a difference together.
If you would pick one challenge that you had to overcome, and the way you've tackled it has been a profound experience or learning, which challenge would you pick?
Well, I think maybe just some of the things we already talked about, but I just think that overcoming the sort of lack of confidence, I know it's held me back. I think just sort of keep trying, keep going. That would be the thing I come back to.
You have developed a passion and desire to invest in women. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, because I am a woman, perhaps I see the opportunities that I think we can contribute to building a business. So I've been incredibly passionate about it. We've devoted a really great effort called Balance the Equation, where we're hoping to double the number of women in science and technology by 2020. So we're actually holding ourselves accountable for getting more women in key roles in the company. And I feel like it's my job to make sure more women are successful in the company. That being said, I'm always mindful. I believe diversity is what makes innovation happen. And so it can't just be about just being a woman. You know, you have to have different points of view and different perspectives. And I think it's my role to have more diverse minds at the table. So really, that's as much what I think my mission is here.
All our guests at Role Models, both in the event series that we host in Berlin and on this podcast, are women. So what advice can you share with me as an ally to create and foster a more diverse workplace?
I think just one, state you're open for business for diverse thinkers and mean it. So people have to see there's someone like them to believe they can go work there. So I think they need to see people with different styles, different backgrounds, an eclectic team. If the team all looks the same, look, it could be perfectly gender balanced, but everybody is an engineer or everybody's a marketer. They all think the same way. I think that's a start, but it's not enough. So I think people need to see that you value people with different experiences, different backgrounds. I know that GE is a better company because we're more globally diverse. We've got more people from all experiences, all kinds of nationalities. We're much better than we were 20 years ago because of that. People have to see it. You can't just say it. They have to see it.
Soraya, who you mentioned earlier, told me I should ask you about art. Talk a bit about your passion for art.
I love art. I love design. I think it just takes your mind to different places. I love the way artists express themselves. It just makes me think. So I try to do as much as I can, certainly in the course of the business, to marry art with science. And so as much as I think technology matters, I think in the age of robotics and artificial intelligence and machine learning and all the things that we're getting in our focus, we can't lose sight of creativity. And I think in the machine age, perhaps all we'll have left is our creativity. And if we're not expressing it, we're going to be left behind.
Who's your favorite artist right now?
Well, my favorite artist, I mean, there's so many artists I like. My favorite artist is Basquiat. I love the chaos of that. I just love that kind of expression. One of the more recent exhibits that I love Raymond Pettibon, who's been at the New Museum here in New York City. I just love his expressiveness and sort of the irony that he brings. Both the words and the paint, the drawings that he does, the illustration. So that's somebody new who I've come to appreciate.
Which place in the world have you never been and you want to go next?
Any place I haven't been is usually where I want to go next. So that is, right now on my list is I want to go to Sri Lanka. I haven't been to Sri Lanka, and for some reason that seems very intriguing to me.
Where can people find you? Like where, if people want to follow your thinking or where would you point people?
I'm trying to put myself out there a lot more in social media. Again, not a natural act, but you can find me on LinkedIn, Facebook, Medium. I've been doing a lot more. I'm trying to do a lot more thought pieces on Medium. I'd love to encourage people. I've been really taken with this notion of emergence and this idea that in a fast changing world, there are a lot of new patterns emerging that we have to be ready for, and that the idea of a business plan, the idea of a strategic plan is probably over as new things emerge. So how as leaders do we put ourselves open to more feedback, be more adaptable? That's something I'm really excited about. So that would be an area. Let's discuss something like that around Medium.
Beth, you've been very generous with your time. Thanks, on a David. Saturday after a long flight. Thank you so much for coming on a podcast, and all the best to you.
Thanks. I've enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks again to Beth for sharing her story and so many great pieces of advice. And thank you for listening to this episode. I'm currently working on the next 20 interviews and would love to hear from you. I would love to hear from you what topics you would be most interested in. So here are three questions. What is something that you're learning right now or would love to learn in the next 3 to 6 months? Question number two. What are some of the current challenges that you're facing in life or in your career? And question number three, who would be your dream guest to have on the Role Models podcast? You can pick one or two or all of the three questions and let me know your thoughts. You can email me at david@rolemodels.co, and I really look forward to hearing from you. If you would like to support this podcast, the single best way you can do that right now is to go to iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, post a really short review, and use the star rating. Thank you so much for your support. Thank you so much for being part of the last 20 episodes. And I hope to see you here again for the next 20 episodes.